aerobic capacity, step aerobics.
Yeah.
this is our step aerobics lecture. So everyone, go ahead and get out your boxes,
your headbands.
Yeah, get your headbands, get your wristbands,
your colored tights,
leotards. This is gonna be a great discussion on how to best set up your box, how to color coordinate, leotard, sweatband, headband, all of the above. What we're gonna talk about. Michael has a long and storied CrossFit career, being around in the early days. Oh, you got your $1,000 t-shirt on, huh?
Nope, I don't. This is actually from Beyond the Whiteboard gave me this.
Oh, okay.
But they never aired the podcast.
Oh, they did a podcast and then decided that.
I did a podcast with them at the games in 2015, I think, and they didn't air it.
Decided it wasn't good enough, huh?
I don't know if it was that. Might have been a few, maybe a bit critical of a couple of things, and that was enough.
Cool. Yeah. Well,
I do remember saying on the podcast that year, though, about how I didn't believe the regionals were selecting the best athletes to get to the games. And my prime example was Brent Fikowski did not reach the games.
Yeah.
And we're like, what does that mean? I'm like, well, because he's guaranteed to finish top 10 here. And then the next year he finished fourth.
Yep.
Because just look at it. You're like, anyway, that's the other discussion, but that's one of the things I remember saying on that podcast, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. A controversial opinion that, turned out to be right. But I think that, the goal today is to kind of give some framework for applying aerobic training in mixed modal work, right? That's something that's, people are starting to become aware that, hey, this aerobic capacity stuff matters, that CrossFit isn't just about your max snatch and your max clean and jerk, that, you have to have some endurance capacity. You know, there's a lot of folks putting out some good information and some smart work in terms of like, here's how to maybe do some interval training. Not all your training should result in you being on the ground afterwards, that maybe you want to do some longer stuff. But there's a lot of details there that matter in terms of applying this correctly. And then there's also a lot of confusion surrounding, okay, I can do all this work on, let's say, swimming or biking or running or rowing or whatever, but I still suck at, thrusters and double unders. What's going on there? There's a lot to touch on, but I think that with you and your background, having started doing CrossFit way back in the day, some appearances at the games, coached many regionals and games competitors, that you've seen the actual evolution of what, training in the sport has looked like and what the role of that aerobic training is. And that there's probably a lot to learn just from, going through some of what that history looks like.
Yeah. It's funny thinking back on it and looking back it's funny looking back on how some of the training I would give people. And then like back in 2009 is when I think I first started like coaching some, actually, I think one of my first clients was Alex Netty.
Oh yeah.
I think that was in 2009. One of my first ones. Anyway, such a gifted athlete, super great guy. Anyway, so like taking that all as a whole and the training that we used to do kind of in 2008, 2009, and 2010, or that I did. And then there was kind of like a bit of a switch there in 2011, 2012 for myself. And I can see that happen in the programming I would give people. But as a whole, like kind of back in the, call them the early days or whatever of CrossFit is that, like number one, compared to now, the training that I would give people, there's just way more of it. And that's on all fronts from all characteristics. Like the training, the total volume of each session or the total volume per week is just, I don't know what I would venture to say the number is, but it's at least twice as much in the course of a week. It might actually be three times. And that's like both in part of like the progression of how things have gone and what people have adapted to. But then the people that are rising to the top of the sport are just better. They're just better athletes in general. And their ability to withstand and handle the work week in and week out and month in and month out is just better than than we were in 2008, 2009, 2010. I would also say that my focus back then was very much on just on the energy systems themselves. So, and taking like kind of taking the brain out of it and think of it more in terms of like a robot. It's like just improve the engine of the robot and everything will work out. You don't need to really worry so much about like the skill, the precision, the strategy, looking at what the actual limitations of that athlete are. It's more about just improve the actual, the base ability and everything will get better. That's kind of what my thinking was more around. It's not that that's all it was, but it was way more centralized around this, this idea that whatever feeds the machine in terms of the energy is what you need to really focus on.
Yeah. And I think that there is also, your brother James puts out this energy systems chart and, you know, everyone's like, oh, here's the answer. Like, here's, you know, you just work this much and you rest this much and you just get good. Like, it's very linear. Like, it's cool.
And I remember that. I believe it came from a biathlon training manual. I believe, and I might be wrong in that, that it was Nelson Aouet who actually had that chart and had like the energy systems in terms of like the map numbers or the map like layouts and all that stuff and the going from alactic out and all that. Anyway, but it was good because it kind of gave a lot. I'd say the function that it really had that was really beneficial is it provided people with framework of like looking at it and going, oh, okay, so this works and that works. And, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting. Instead of it just being complete chaos all the time, right? Which it still kind of is. So number one being the volume was way lower back then. Number two, I think the focus was way largely around that specific focus on developing the energy system aspect from, like you said, like creatine phosphate, anaerobic, aerobic type stuff. And then number three, what did I have here? Which anyone that was really into it back then, there was more focus and more exposure and more chronic exposure to truly maximal intensities in energy system work. And that kind of makes sense in terms of how the volume has changed over the years. And that if you're truly doing maximal intensity efforts, which I really was trying to do back then, you just can't train a lot. You just can't, and you won't want to really, because it takes such a toll on you. And the simple example for people to understand that about is like even the regional athletes that train and prepare. So let's say 2 weeks before the regionals, they do all the regional events, and you know, Tuesday or whatever, they can come back in after the 3-day weekend and they're fine. And they're like, okay, well, let's get back at it and get going. Whereas when you do it at the regional event itself, you can't do that because you're broken on Tuesday. And it's just the sheer amount of effort and emotion and intensity that goes into it. Some of the base understanding for people is that the amount of effort you're putting into it generally is going to work with like having a less amount of it. And if you work very, like if your intensity is rather low, you can go for a long time. Which kind of fits into the first part that we wanted to cover. I'd say one of the most important things that individuals, you can correct me here, Todd, but are we talking to individuals that are trying to think about how they're going to do it for themselves?
Yeah, I think it's probably a blend of folks who are athletes as well as some people who, you know, train, but are more so coaches, but they want to kind of know the ins and outs of how to write prescriptions and all that sort of stuff. So kind of an in-between crowd.
Okay. So we'll cover we'll try to cover that. So one of the things that's important to think about, regardless if you're a coach or the athlete, specifically if you're the coach though, but also as the athlete, because you're the one that has to really understand it, is when you're designing these types of training sessions or you're designing your training sessions in general, is that you have to have an understanding of a perceived exertion and like what people would call RPE, so your rating of perceived exertion. So if as the coach you're writing these sessions and they seem quite long and they seem like quite voluminous and you're also expecting maximal intensity, you have to think about that in the course of a week and how that thing works over the course of a week and then how that happens over the course of months and years. So if you have this whatever session you're thinking of, and you're going to do it on Monday, and it's very long, but it's also maximally, it has a lot of intensity to it. You have to think about it kind of like multiplying those two things together. So it's a really high intensity and it's very, very long. That's a really big training load. So it's a lot of work to recover from. And then like on the opposite side of things, if your training is quite low intensity and the duration is quite low, that's a very low training load. And how you scatter that throughout the week and how you think of that stuff is important in terms of your athlete's recovery from day to day and week to week, and how you're going to, like, when you're going to really push the buttons and make it really challenging, and when you're going to kind of ease off a little bit, and how you're going to do that and how it's going to flow throughout the week. Because in my opinion, in the opinion of many others, that it's better to kind of change that a bit. So if this day is going to be really big, or this AM session is really challenging, then maybe the PM and maybe the next day should be a little smaller in terms of that training load. It doesn't mean it has to be short. It just means that it can't be maximal intensity like it was the day before, or the way things are being structured cannot be the same. So if you're just going to do a 20-minute AMRAP on Monday at a maximal effort, then do it again on Tuesday, then Wednesday, then Thursday, and Friday, a very extreme example, but that's not the best way to approach getting better at aerobic training or becoming more conditioned for the sport. It's not a long-term solution to do it like that. And then so kind of within that, so thinking in terms of like when you're looking at the way your training sessions work of perceived exertion, fitting into that is like the variation in intensities you're going to play with in your sessions. So going back to the example of doing 20-minute AMRAPs 5 days a week, if you're just doing it, I'm doing them for the maximal amount of reps you can get every time, then it's not only is the layout of the session is the same each week, each day, but the intensity of the session is the exact same each day. So one of the most important things that I try to get across to athletes is understanding pacing. And what that really means is having them experience different intensities. So having a wide range of intensities built into the training is a good thing mentally, I think, as it's just not repetitive and it's varied. And it's also good in terms of education. So for the athlete to understand what these paces feel like to them, and how that kind of affects how that feels like to them, because then that's really what will affect how a competition event will function, because you have to learn how to know what you actually feel like and how that's going to play out 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes later in an event, as opposed to just knowing how to do one pace when an event may require or call for a different pace to really excel at it, and you don't really know what that feels like.
Yeah, and I think that's something that can be difficult for people is understanding, I mean, not just like the concept of, you know, okay, I need to feel these different intensities, but the actual prescription of it, right? So that, you know, you, for example, will write something like, whatever, 5-minute AMRAP at 85%, rest 5 minutes times 3, or, you know, 75% effort or 90% effort.
Yeah.
And that, you know, people's brains, a certain set of people's brains immediately go to like a linear math problem. And they're like, okay, cool. This is just like my back squat. I take 90% of my maximum pace. Yeah. I calculate it. Here's my spreadsheet. Cool. My split time needs to be this, 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 and this. And like, that's going to be my 90% effort. Oh, 85% effort. Cool. Like, let me, you know, I'll adjust that by 5%. Yeah. And that's really not necessarily what, you know, we're trying to accomplish by prescribing like a percentage effort, that we're really looking more for an understanding of like what that actual rate of perceived exertion is.
Yeah. And like, I'd say when I write that stuff, I'm expecting the individual to take that to themselves and try to put that out on, try to take it in what that means to them and then put it out. Where I really think like over time, I'll just change it to a perceived exertion scale. Cause I think people understand it better and they look at it. But yeah, like, and so just going back to the intensity discussion is that a lot of people just have this one effort that they go at. And even if I ask people to do an easy effort for 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes, whatever, of something quite simple, they gravitate to the same pace they would kind of use if I told them to do 60 minutes for max effort. It's not that much different. And that always strikes me as something interesting, is to go like, what is it about them? Like, why do they do that? Do they do that because like it's the ego side of things, where they just think that unless it's hard, it's not beneficial. Like there's no upside to doing it unless it's really, really intensive. Or is it they just don't know? Like, what is it? Like, basically that would probably fit the two main categories. But many times I think people just do not believe that, they don't understand the idea of doing a lot of work and having to slow down. I just think a lot, specifically in my athletes, I think of is I just don't think they believe it. Like, they don't believe that, you should go slow at any point. Or just take time to just do the work and slow down.
Yeah. So you gave me a session, maybe a week or two ago. I think it was, let's say 20 minutes at 75% effort of, I think, 50 row calories at damper of one, 10 bottoms up Turkish get ups, and then 100 single under, something to that effect. And so, you know, well, why wouldn't I just row my row calories at a 1200 calorie per hour pace? I could probably do it, and I could probably get through it. And it would be hard. So why wouldn't I get more out of doing that for 20 minutes than rowing at whatever, 850 calories per hour?
Yeah, good question.
Fine. Like, that's like, I'm in the gym. Why shouldn't I just be hard? It'll
kill it. Generally, and then for someone like yourself and for many others too, is I like to reserve the intensity. I like to reserve a lot of the intensity work for more sports specific work. As opposed to I don't call it wasting intensity on the ergs, but if you're gonna do longer, easier pieces, it should mainly be on the ergs, in my opinion, because I don't really see how you do it another way, and actually have a continued, sustained like blood flow, oxygen requirement. But then in terms of like the intensity work, that's not how the sport works. Like, the sport isn't ergs. The sport is very much not ergs in terms of fitness. Like, in most cases, most athletes will never get to do an event that has just the erg in it, ever. In most cases, the erg isn't even important. It usually just sits there. And now it's not always like that, but for the large majority of people listening and doing CrossFit, you're doing the open, right? That's the farthest you're getting. And more often than not, it's a rower or it's just skipping double unders. And specifically with the rower, it traditionally doesn't have a huge part to play in the open. It's there, but it's not determining your success like a clean is, or like your ability to do chest or bar pull-ups and thrusters together. So it's just totally different. You mentioned something there about the intensity, and I can't remember what I was going to say.
I think what people's question is like, well, if I can do more work during that, like, why shouldn't I just do it? Like, I mean, I'll just push the pace a little bit. Like, I'll get out of breath. Mm-hmm. I'll get sweaty. Like, I'll have to sit on the ground for a while after. Like, if I don't have to like kind of bend over after my session, why even bother doing it?
Yeah. So it's like, I'd say sometimes I explain it to people that really don't understand, is to help them understand. Is to like, so when they do like weightlifting work and whatever, like, why don't I just give them max efforts all the time? Why don't you just do max efforts all the time? And intuitively, they know why. They know why they don't do that, because they know it doesn't work. Unless they're extremely skilled and they lift once a week, and then they'll just do max efforts, whatever. But people understand. I think people really understand the aspect of progression in terms of weightlifting and gymnastics and working through things to build other things and doing this thing to build that thing and doing this to help this. Like, they get that. But I think a lot of times when it comes to conditioning, they don't understand that. A lot of people just think of it in terms of just a dummy system. It's like, get in there, kill yourself, leave. And honestly, for people that are really skilled and really able, that system works. Because you'll just go in, you'll practice, and you're a very intelligent athlete, and you'll learn a lot while you're doing it. And just like infrequent exposures to certain modalities at really high intensities will give you the training effect you need. But in my opinion, that's a very small percentage of the people that are listening to this, or the people that I'm going to work with. That's a very small percentage of those people that are like that. So really, again, the first thing I want to cover was just to have people understand what perceived exertion is and how that actually factors into it. So to the question you just asked is, if I have a 20-minute piece to start my training session, plus I have more afterwards, why don't I just max it out? It's like, well, because the way it was written there, it's there to function as a warm-up. And it's there to function to give you more time to just practice breathing and just to get maximal blood flow, which is why it's set up the way it is, as a preparation for the next part. And if you go too hard, then you're screwing the actual important part of the session, which was the middle part. So the middle part was the main focus. If I wanted you to go hard, I would just cut out the 20 minutes at the beginning and go, okay, well, if you're not going to do it right, then just don't do it, just because that's not the focus of the whole session. The focus is this. There's no point in you killing yourself on this when this is the priority. Because then you're not going to get out of that what I want you to get out of it. So that, again, that goes back again to the understanding of there needs to be a difference in intensities in your training. Just like you would do with weightlifting and squatting and deadlifting, and just why people practice progressions in gymnastics, practicing and exposing yourself to different intensities in your training program is important. And it's not to say that everyone needs to do like low intensity work all the time, because some people definitely don't. But if you are going to go ahead and do it, it needs to actually be low intensity, because otherwise you're just messing with the other things. So with those two things, understanding RPE of a training session and how that fits into a training load, the amount of work you have to recover from, and understanding that the intensity of your training sessions should not always be the same pace, same intensity. Then the third thing you get into, which is important, is you have to assess the need. So if you're someone who's really, really good at doing a lot of people I talk with could just call it like to do long sweaty workouts. So like that's my favorite stuff, like long sweaty workouts, which means like light weights, tons of reps and whatever. Like that's what they love doing. So in terms of that, like, do they need to obtain greater ability to move oxygen around? Maybe doubtful. When you look at the other things in the grand scheme of things, maybe themselves as an athlete, their need is just strictly in terms of like contractile strength. Like they need to get stronger and as fast as they can at these things with a bar and with rings and pushing themselves up and down. Like the need is in terms of muscular strength. The need isn't in terms of fatigue resistance. So those people aren't looking to obtain more in terms of work capacity. And then you have the other people who maybe based on where they are in the sport and the years of training they've had in it, maybe their goal is to just maintain their ability. Like they want to maintain where they're at. And then you have the other people who are very extreme on one way or the other. And usually I talk with them about knowingly detraining their abilities. So again, a simple example is like, let's say just really, really easy example. Someone who's like a triathlete for some reason knocks on your door and is like, hey, I want to go to the CrossFit Games. Like, all right, well, interesting. But so in terms of thinking about knowingly detraining them, is that you're going to have to knowingly make them worse at triathlon to make them better at CrossFit. That's just a very simple example. They're going to have to get worse at many things that they're currently really good at to get better at the things that matter. And then on the other side of things, so someone who's really, really, really great at weightlifting, squatting, deadlifting, whatever. And let's just put some numbers to it. So again, like you just take a guy who's 200 pounds, if they're front squatting like 425, 450, and like snatching 315 and clean and jerking like what, 380 or something, is that really required for them to get from 600th in the open to get to 100th? No. So with that individual, if their goal was truly to get better at CrossFit, you would have to talk to them and go, all right, based on what we're seeing here and what's showing up in the other things in their training. So it's like, yeah, my shoulders always die when I get to, when I do this many reps. It's like maybe I need to work more on my dips. It's like, yeah, I don't know if it's specific. I don't know if it's your dips. I think it's the fact that you're just so strong. You actually, it has a negative impact on your ability to be sustainable. So you have to like tell these people that we have to kind of train you out of this a little bit, and it's going to mean that you just don't get exposure to it. So that's what I mean by knowingly detraining certain things. And that, because sometimes you have to let some things go to actually be better. You just have to. And then you have to know at what areas are you like really great at and what areas are you really poor at. Because you're going to get the most benefit out of raising up the areas you're poor at. And those things are generally going to require more exposure and more focus to actually make meaningful improvements. Than it is to still spend 50% of your time and effort working on the things you're actually still really, really good at. So like, again, I think people say like a lot of new clients I would have this, like I always ask them the question of if they have like a favorite type of training to do or what's their favorite type of workouts. And it's usually either the most common answers are either I love weightlifting and I love like short, fast events and doing that type of stuff. Or I like really light, long, sweaty events with lots of work. And I'm not really fond of like grunty barbell and gymnastic stuff. I'm not sure what you would usually hear from people.
That gives you some insight right there. Unless maybe they're just someone who loves working on stuff that they suck at. They're like, yes, it feels so good to just challenge.
Yeah, well, that's not usually common. That's not the most common demeanor is for people to go, yeah, my favorite thing to do is all the stuff that I'm really bad at. Okay, so again, just to review again, the perceived exertion and why that matters, variations in intensity, and assessing the actual need. And then you go to like assessing where the need is. Like where is the need? Is the need in terms of like, they actually just have not had any exposure to activity their whole life. So they're pretty much brand new. And they don't have like, whatever you want to call it. Like they basically don't have the hardware in their system to move blood around. They don't have it. They haven't done it. They can't get blood to the blood and oxygen to the areas that need to be there. Like they need to get them to, because they just generally have not had any work on them. So their body hasn't had to adapt to anything besides just breathing. Versus an athlete who comes to you with like 10 years of being a hockey player at a high level, the way that person's going to present to you and the things that they're going to need to do to get better are not the same. If you just put those two people on the same training program, you'll just see that occur in front of you and watch how people approach things and watch how people recover from things. So just looking at the need of the individual is very important. The one thing you mentioned about discussing about like bridging the gap between, so let's just say the beginner, so if we're going to say a beginner, like what are we describing? Like who are we describing in this? It's not necessarily like the age of the individual. It's more in terms of just their training age, which most people probably, I'd say they probably heard that term before, but it's like, it's the experience that they would have in terms of actually, intensive focused efforts. I explain to people that, like, you know, you could have people that go to a YMCA for 20 years that have a low training age. They're like, how does that make sense? I'm like, well, because they're not doing anything. Like they're not really, really exposing themselves to and really stressing themselves to get as good as they possibly can. And to push them as far as they can into their potential, because that's really what you're going after. So they can be working out and kind of dilly-dallying around, and they'll be at a lower training age, meaning they're inexperienced, they don't have a good understanding of how their body works, and they're nowhere near their potential. And then that was the example of the person who comes to you as an athlete that starts CrossFit that has absolutely no exposure to anything versus someone who's been playing competitive sports for a long time, they'll come into it with kind of, I guess you would kind of say, a higher training age, even though it's not specific to the sport. And just the way that those individuals are going to work and the way you're going to, the training that they're going to go through is just different, because their understanding of what intensity is already somewhat there, and their ability to handle and recover it is better than the other person. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And I think that's something that would be, you know, an initial question related to that would be, okay, cool. So we can figure out potentially where someone is at, and that may dictate, you know, okay, can we expect to, you know, just kind of give them some stuff and see a ton of improvement, versus we're going to have to be a bit more surgical with how we actually are thinking about prescribing stuff. And then the question would be, okay, cool. Like, say we do need to be more particular, then how, can we, you know, decide what actual training stimulus we want from that individual, right? Like, how do we decide, like, okay, cool, we want to make sure that you're doing a lot of easy work, or we want to make sure that you're doing, you know, higher intensity work and making sure you have the ability to recover between that.
Yep. And that goes into a good part of, so regardless of who you're working with, right, you need to do baseline assessments and baseline tests, and then you need to retest them, and then continually retest them. In different ways or whatever, or have a large variety of tests that you're going to test and retest to see what's happening. Because otherwise it's subjective improvements, right? Like, you're making subjective improvements because you feel better. You feel like you're doing better, which is good, because obviously it's adding to the person's confidence. But if this person needs to obtain improvements, then you better see it in a variety of tests, not just one. So like, if you take 10 different tests and 9 of them are CrossFit type tests, and one of them is an air bike and they got better at the air bike, that's okay, but that's not really that important, because obviously whatever you're doing is making them better at the air bike, which is cool. But if it's not making them better at the sport, then what are you doing? You're again, like, I would call that, you're training to be good at training. You're not training to be good at the sport, which is not the same thing. It's like, yes, I'm getting really, really good at my golf practice, but it doesn't actually make me any better at golf, and my scores are just the same or worse. It's like, so whatever you're doing, it's making you better at your practice, but unless your practice is making you better at the sport, you need to reevaluate what that is. And so, like, if we just pick the beginner, I think, like, the basic idea of endurance training, of just exposing people to gradually more and more work volume in running, biking, rowing, skiing, and that type of stuff, has a huge benefit because they have not been exposed. So if they have not been exposed, they are going to see, or they should see, a really good improvement in terms of, like, their work capacity in those modalities fairly quickly. And that in itself will have an improvement in the sport of CrossFit, because they went from a base, like an absolute zero level of ability in terms of, like, their VO, we'll just call it their VO2 max. Like, if they improve their ability to take oxygen in, which is a pretty, it's a marker. It's not the be all end all by any means, but it's a marker of what's going on. If they improve that, that's going to have an improvement in the sport, or at least it should for someone at that level. Yeah, like, I think that's the more popular route people take now, wouldn't you say? Like, a lot of people take, not a lot, I want to say a lot of people, but that's the more common route, is to take like an endurance program that's basically just all running, or it's all about just biking and it's just rowing and whatever, and how that's going to factor in, and how I think people are incorrectly assuming that making improvements, like, on your run time here is going to factor into how well you do on Amanda. And going, I think a lot of people lose the fact that those two things are not necessarily connected. At some points, and what I'm saying right now for the beginner, like, yeah, if you are if you've never done anything, doing this stuff and getting better at rowing, biking, running, skiing is going to affect your Amanda time. It's just going to. You're going to just feel better, even if you stay. If you stay, just basically take the idea, the person stays at the same technical proficiency. They stay at the same, like, strength level. If all you did was improve their VO2 max from a very low amount to a moderate amount, they're likely going to perform better at Amanda. But once you take that advanced level athlete and you move them from whatever, like over, they're on already very high level on rowing, biking, skiing, and running, will that affect their Amanda time? And the answer is, I have no idea if it will. That's the part where it becomes interesting, in that the traditional endurance work, I just don't feel like it'll function the same way with those elite level athletes in the sport.
Yeah.
And that type of training has a different, to me, has a different purpose for those people.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you bring up Amanda, or we could use any number of sort of like benchmark CrossFit workouts, but that, you know, the people who are elite in the sport of CrossFit are able to make workouts like that aerobic, quote unquote, and that they, you know, feel to them probably somewhat similar to the way that doing like cyclical work might feel to someone else over that time, right? Where they're able to just like maintain blood flow and oxygen transport, like throughout the course of doing whatever, squat snatches and muscle ups, or double unders and thrusters, or chest bar and overhead squats, that, you know, that work to them feels not the same way that it does to like most other people. So, you know, I think the idea is that ideally, by building up that engine, that we're able to potentially turn that mixed work into that more aerobic feeling work, but it's not always that simple. For some people, they may actually have pretty good capacity when it comes to like purely cyclical pieces, but that they're unable to then express that capacity in like a mixed modal environment. Right. You can also see the opposite, where some people are actually quite poor at like, you know, high turnover cyclical stuff, but they have this incredible capacity to like make this sort of like muscle endurance grindy work, like quote unquote aerobic, in the way that other folks are.
Yeah, there's definitely that. There's that crossover with a lot of people. I feel like I was very much like that when I was at my best in fitness, and that the cyclical pieces I was very, very, very good at. And I was okay at the CrossFit stuff. And that's the funny part of it, is like, so back in like 20, I believe it was 2012 or 2011, when they first did that thruster chest to bar ladder, right? In the open. Yeah, it was 2011. It was the last workout. And like back at that time, I was much fitter in terms of rowing, biking, running than I am right now. And I beat my score this year from doing that. So how does that work? Right. So like, that's just like me talking about how it worked. But like in terms of like my ability to run, row, bike is much worse now than it was in 2011. And I'm heavier. But I still did better at chest bar pull-ups and thrusters. It's because like, there's a lot more to it. So my ability to relax at the right times doing chest to bar, and my ability to breathe at the right times and move the bar properly on thrusters has increased immensely. So the amount of work I actually do to perform that workout now is much less than it was, which has nothing to do with my ability to run. It's the skill and the adaptation of the athlete that made that improvement. Now, if I had all that, plus I maintain my ability of just the base endurance work, would that make me even better? Probably. But when you talk about people that are more trained, I just can't say yes anymore. I can't say like, yeah, that will make me better. I have to say, I don't know, maybe we'll have to see how this all plays out for you and how it works for you and what that individual is getting out of doing it. Right. So again, well, just to reiterate, we're talking about like doing lots of running work, lots of rowing work, lots of biking work, lots of skiing work. For some people, maybe they might actually get a lot out of that training for them. They might actually get a lot out of it. Their body might actually adapt more and have a greater like broad adaption than some people. And that's really what we're talking about, is like the beginner, I think, will have a really broad adaption. As they go from very low confidence to moderate confidence. But the adaptation becomes much smaller, in my opinion, as you go from the moderate level person to someone who's very advanced. And like, again, the example we discussed earlier, I think it was offline, was like, what's the benefit of someone my size going from a 640 time on the rower for a 2 kilometer race, which is a 140 pace, down to 636. So it's 139. Like, what's the upside of that for me in the sport?
Not a lot.
I don't know, right? I'm not sure. But what's the upside of me getting like an extra 6 muscle ups unbroken, or like 3 muscle ups unbroken, or 2? Like, there is an upside to that. Like, there's an objective upside, because that can function automatically. And usually, every year you get an opportunity to test the things that actually matter. So I think we're getting a bit off topic here, but the bridging the gap thing. So basically, for the beginner, I think doing the standard old, like, I guess we want to just call it, we want to call them work rest scenarios of, is that what you want to call them?
Yeah. You mean just like the standard, like 500 meter row, rest 90 seconds times 10.
Yeah. So something like that. So let's just say the most classic one being like, 500 meter row at your 2K pace, rest anywhere between 1 to 2 minutes, do anywhere between 5 to 15 sets. That we'll call that the beginner approach. And I think the reason for like, in terms of the way that you would move past that, is that in terms of like people that become more and more advanced, and they start understanding how to, like, they learn all the movements, they know how to do everything. The main function for me I see in using the ergs specifically on their own is in terms of just kind of adding extra work volume to the week, as opposed to making that a centerpiece of anything. So it's when athletes start going, hey, I want to do, like, I have time to do 3 morning sessions now, and it's easy for my schedule. To me, the first way I like to add that is monostructural work. So it's just like, they're just going to bike or row or probably run or swim. Because to me, that you have an automatic extra work being done. But the initial increase is much easier to adapt to, in my opinion, or much easier to, handle, so that you're not going from a current training layout of training 5 times a week where you're doing fine to adding 3 extra sessions. And they're 3 really intense CrossFit type sessions. And then you start feeling 2 or 3 weeks later that you're just really, really tired. So the point of that being, okay, I think the initial increase will just do it rowing, biking, skiing, running type stuff, so you can get that extra work in, but you're not actually too beat up from it. So it's not really taking away from a lot of other things. And the good thing for that too, just as an aside, is that I think for people that are more in terms of they need to get just stronger and whatever, like bigger and stronger and faster, I believe a lot of like spending a lot of time on the ergs as opposed to doing a lot of CrossFit type work might be a better idea. Just cause you're just generally it's easier to recover from, right? There's no real eccentric loading component. You can kind of finish the session and move on. You don't have to worry about kind of how you feel the next day, cause you're not really going to be sore from it, versus if you're filling that extra time with doing squatting and burpees and box jumps and deadlifts. And you know, some people can handle that and be okay with it, but I just don't think it's the safest or the best way to go about making someone stronger while also working to maintain, if not improve, their work capacity.
Yeah, so we can use these cyclical pieces as like essentially a volume add for either adding additional training sessions or also like within a specific session where it's like, okay, cool, we want you to be moving for an hour doing some form of intervals with work rest scenarios. And, you know, if we're, say we're doing 1 minute on, 1 minute off, then at some point we might just start to get mechanical breakdown. If it's like dumbbell thruster, burpee box jump, double under, kettlebell swing, you know, but we want you to be able to do that for 45, 60 minutes. Like, okay, well maybe we need to slot in ski erg, air bike and rowing just so like you're moving that entire time and not just hitting the point where you're like, well, guess what? My low back doesn't work anymore, so I can't do this.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was getting at, right? So if you do that second workout, let's say your Monday morning workout is like snatching, some intensive gymnastics and some accessory work for your upper body and, lower body, like in terms of lunging, dumbbell rows, whatever. And in the afternoon, this is where your extra session was going to be. I think the first place to start with for you is to do rowing, biking, or skiing mainly. Because then when you show up on Tuesday morning to do your normal 1-a-day session, whatever that's going to be, I feel like that's the best way for you to be able to handle that extra one, that extra training session, is in a non-intensive, low loading, low eccentric loading environment to start with. And I emphasize to start with, but that to start with phase could last 6 to 12 months for some people, depending on how well they advance through it. Right. And some people may not ever be able to handle, their two-a-day sessions being anything but the second one has to be monostructural. They may never get past that. That may always just be, that's the way it has to be for me, because I can't handle the workload, or I can't recover from it. So then you might have to ask a different question and go, maybe you just don't need to do that second one. right? Like, maybe that's not the answer.
No, but doubles.
Yeah. So I think initially adding volume is an important aspect if you're trying to increase your aerobic capacity. Like a tried and true method is you have to do more work. You're not going to be an elite marathoner if you run 5 miles a week. Like it's not going to happen. No matter how sweet your 5 miles is, it's just not going to work. Cause there's a missing key. It's like, okay, you're not running enough. And that's as simple as we can make it right now. Like, what if I run 10 miles? Like, no. there's a certain requirement to develop competency, and you have to get to that. Like, you have to, like, the base, the most often, the most important variable to move is volume. But it has to be moved appropriately. And it has to be moved knowing that intensity is contingent upon it. Right, intensity functions within that volume, and then in terms of CrossFit, you have movements and like other things to recover from. So, the easiest way to move volume up would be just moderate intensities, not maximal intensities, and pick modalities that are not going to beat you up. So that's why I say using those as your initial increase in volume. But yeah, like, so actually we kind of talked about it, but it's like the classic work intervals of the work rest intervals, we should say. Those are things that, as well, like back in 2009, 2010, 2011, were quite common as to how I would write them, even 2012, probably 2013. But I use those much less frequently now. And what would you like? I didn't even ask you about this, but when did you start like really coaching people in CrossFit?
It would have been 2010, because I was a coach at a gym. And then I remember people would just be like, hey, will you like give me some workouts to do? And I was like, all right, sure. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah. Here you go. Here's some shit I made up.
Yeah. Do it. Okay. Yeah. So, I'm not sure if you would have the same type of thing with me, where I just say, like, I know over the course of the last 10 years that the way I write training sessions and work rest or work recovery intervals has changed a lot. What would you say?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I said this before, where it used to be much more like linear, where it's like, all right, here's the energy systems chart. This is the way you do it. Like,
yeah,
this shit works. Cool. And I think like with anything, you know, you at some level, you have to follow the rules for a certain amount of time to get an intuition for how it works. And then you start to understand that like real life is messy and chaotic, and that it's not as simple as just a chart. And you're like, okay, but I understand the principles of the chart. So now I can try to play with it and now try to have you know, play with different paces in one session, or purposefully increase or decrease rest to try to get a different stimulus, or just to see what happens.
Yeah. To make it very clear, like those classical intervals of like, again, just use the 500 meter row times 10. If you just modify the variables a bit and shorten the rest and increase the sets, that works. It works to make you better at rowing. It does. And again, the other side of it is that whether that the actual work is physically making you better and physiologically creating adaptation to make you better at rowing, or if it's just giving you more time to practice rowing and it makes your mind more comfortable with working hard on a rower, which is the ultimate limiter anyway. It's just your perception of how much suffering you're willing to go through. So that, but that stuff works. It does. And following those intervals, even the old school, just simply 1 minute of work, 1 minute, even just rest, or 2 minutes of work, 2 minutes of rest, 3 minutes of work, 3 minutes of rest, that will work to improve your performance on even running, on even biking, rowing, skiing. I've seen it almost repeat all the time. But it's like we alluded to initially, is that it's improving those modalities, but is it having a trickle effect, which is what you want? You want it to have a transfer effect to the sport of what you're trying to get better at. And yeah, so thinking of that, like just a simple example, just pick wall balls. Just pick wall balls, for example. Like some people may technically be poor at wall balls and just have shitty technique. So it's like, if you know that about them, like maybe if you're going to start, like let's say we're going to do a minute of wall balls and then into a minute of rowing immediately. And you're going to try to row the minute at what you would consider a 8.5, 9 out of 10 rate of perceived exertion for that time frame, for that session type of look. So it would make more sense, in my opinion, to have the person start with the wall balls because they're poor at technique, and it's more important if they drill doing the reps right, and then as they get tired and then continue the fatigue and continue the tiredness on a rower. And just a simple example, for someone who's very proficient at doing those movements, maybe it makes more sense to start on the rower. It's like, so the issue with you in doing wall balls is not anything technical. It's literally for you figuring out and really getting better at doing the movement as you accumulate fatigue and as you really get a higher breathing rate. And instead of always having them do 50 pull-ups into doing a minute of wall balls, it's like, well, let's just make them do a minute of rowing to give them the kind of idea of, okay, you're tired and now you have to do the movement perfectly. You know you can do it perfectly, but we're just going to add a little bit of stress to it. And that's just a really simple example, but I think that's really where the function of using those modalities has a greater benefit to the more advanced trainees, is to look at those modalities less of training the modality for the modality, so the training rowing to get better at rowing, and worrying about using rowing in a way to add challenges to the sport, or using rowing in a way that it functions in the sport, or using rowing as a way to like challenge certain recovery capacities of the athlete, as opposed to just worrying about training rowing to get better at rowing. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and I think another question related to that type of thing would be, you know, why would you use, let's say, certain work times or certain RPEs? Because I mean, there's any number of things that you could do and throw it under the umbrella of aerobic training. Right. Yeah. It could be, okay, well, why would we do 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off? And why would we do 1 minute on, 1 minute off? Or why would we do something where we're trying to absolutely ride the razor's edge of falling apart, but keeping it together versus doing something, you know, we mentioned some easy work earlier, but even not necessarily easy, but like, you know, this is a not comfortable pace for you, but there's no chance that you're going to fall apart. Do this work at this versus like, I want you to ride it and find out where that threshold actually is.
Yeah. So the first part of that comment, you mentioned why do 30 seconds of work, 30 seconds of rest, recovery, why do that? And again, that's also where things I've changed a lot in terms of how I write it. I would say like back in like 8, 9 years ago, whatever, I would write that frequently of 30 seconds of rowing at a certain pace, 30 seconds of recovery, or 30 seconds of rest times however many. However, I'm not sure that that has much carryover, much benefit anymore in terms of why you would do that. I think for a beginner, it's a nice bite-sized piece. So you give people 30 seconds at that effort, 30 seconds of rest, and mentally it allows them to go, okay, I can do 30 seconds of work. I can do that. And then 45 seconds. So like you're progressing the interval out as the person's like confidence and competency with pacing happens. But you could also do that with longer intervals right away on like rowing, biking, skiing, whatever, is provided you're providing the pace for them. Because really the main issue with, in my opinion, with beginners and starting with longer duration work is they have no concept of how hard to start at. So that's what I meant by your training should you should teach people different intensities in their training so they start having ideas of what these things feel like, and then they can start have like projections of what it's going to feel like, which is the most important, and how it's going to how it's going to occur and what's going to happen. Yeah, so to go back to the 30 seconds of work, I really think that's just a good like it's good like teaching tool, but I definitely don't like using that very often. 30 seconds of work on pretty much any monostructural piece. I would say 30 seconds of work when you do like 30 seconds of wall balls, 30 seconds of reps, 30 seconds of kettlebell swings, whatever. I look at that as like good volume accumulation work as you're preparing for the open, because then you can predict the amount of work someone's doing. You're just giving them practice in the different movements to get them ready for the intensity of, or like an intensive phase coming up, so they can get used to the work. You're like, wow, you've done all this work and you're ready to go. So now we can actually start playing more with the sport. Whereas I don't really look at it as a conditioning tool per se. Obviously it has that effect because like almost anything can be considered improving your conditioning. But it's more like just, it's like a skill practice interval in my opinion, and accumulating volume interval, as opposed to like really focusing on, okay, let's try to see how this person functions in a sporting context. You know what I mean? So like how well you do with 30 seconds of swings and wall balls and double unders in 15 minutes or whatever, with work rest scenarios, and just, okay, now let's just completely remove the rest and let's see how much you do. And a lot of times you'll see people be able to perform and do well on these things in the training. And then once it becomes more sporting, they do horrible. So it's like, yeah, like I thought that you can do the training well and you're getting better at the training, but you're not getting better at the sport. Like you're not understanding how to do this stuff. Anyway, so again, compared to years ago, I'm much more prone to give people long intervals, longer intervals of work, like usually at least try to go for at least 2 minutes or so, but up to like maybe 10 minutes of work intervals and repeating. But again, to go back to the beginners, is that the beginners it's better off starting them shorter, cause it's, again, they can handle it and they can understand it. But just looking at it in terms of people that are at the elite level, I think the really only function of that is a skill focus, or having them practice certain weights or certain, like layouts without going, I don't really want you to do a lot of work of this. I just kind of want you to have exposure to it, because I'm not sure how it's going to function, so I'm going to kind of fit it into this type of layout where it's not really aggressive and it's pretty casual.
Yeah, so it's basically just another tool for accumulating the volume needed to compete in the sport without just smashing people into the ground all the time.
Yeah, like it's a good introduction, I guess, to doing, if you're gonna move from doing like just only your conditioning work as monostructural, which that's generally not a good idea. But if you're going to move from that, that might be a good starting point for everyone. Because a huge difference you're going to notice immediately is the muscular endurance requirement of those intervals, as opposed to just jumping headlong into doing 10-minute, like 8, 9 out of 10 efforts and then repeating them. That might not be the best starting point for you, because you're probably not ready to start doing them. Kind of like how you would say, like, okay, if you haven't run a lot, maybe doing mile repeats at a certain pace is not the best thing to do, because you haven't even run enough to even be able to do the training. Like, you need to get fit enough to actually do the training that's going to make you better. Yeah. I don't know what else we had to cover on that, but I feel like we're all over the place.
Yeah, no, we're giving the people some good info. That's what they want.
I feel like it's chaotic. I feel like we're all over the place.
Yeah, it's like CrossFit.
It's constantly varied information. just coming at you from everywhere. That's super funny.
Yeah, but I mean, we're coming up on about an hour, so yeah. I guess in terms of summary of like what we've been talking about, other than just chaos, I think the idea is that, you know, with aerobic training, you know, we're looking at a sport that requires significant demands on the aerobic system, and that people who are quite good in the sport are able to utilize their aerobic system extremely effectively to recover between stuff and provide energy to them in ways that people who are not as good simply can't do. Right. And that's one of the potential separators between those who are good at competing and those who are not good at competing is their ability to recover between reps, recover between movements, recover between events throughout a day, and then also just make the actual stuff that they're doing feel more like aerobic training than those who are not quite as good. So it makes a lot of sense that people are concerned with training their aerobic system, right? That they know that this is part of the sport and it will make them better. But the reality is that we have a lot of different ways in which we can do that. We can do that in, you know, easy skill work based ways. We can do it in ways that just kind of accumulate volume on, you know, different, cardio devices, so to speak, right? We can have a bunch of skiing, rowing, et cetera. And we can also start to layer the stuff in with mixed pieces at varying degrees of effort and varying lengths of time. And then all of those things have value, but it's not always clear necessarily which of those pieces are going to translate into improvements in the sport for an individual. And that will also vary between individuals, depending on, I mean, like we talked about training age, you know, where on the spectrum they sit. Are they more of an explosive athlete? Are they someone who tends to already be more enduring? Is this someone who has, you know, very obvious muscle endurance limiting factors? Is this someone who, you know, simply just gets out of breath and like can't sustain a power output? That the prescription for each of those individuals should vary, but you know, it's not necessarily simple in terms of like what that prescription should look like. So, you know, we've given people a lot of different tools to think about and ways to sort of try to ask themselves questions about, well, why am I doing this? Am I giving myself, you know, an appropriate structure of difficult sessions and easy sessions throughout the week? Am I structuring my sessions such that I'm recovering properly? Am I setting things up so that I can actually, you know, learn during my training rather than just, like you said before, have one pace that I go at and I just kind of go into my workout and I go a little too fast and I get tired and then I grind it to the end, right? That's not really the way we want to be training. So, you know, there's a lot there. But I mean, it's a lot of guesswork and trial and error, but there are some solid principles that can actually tie all this stuff together in terms of creating a training program that makes sense. So, I mean, kind of a summary of our chaos there. But I mean, based upon that, you know, if there were takeaways for people in terms of thinking about how they should approach aerobic training sessions in their own training and how they should think about laying it out throughout a week, what would you say?
So I'd say we just go back through the reiterating thing. So part one, start thinking of one, the effort of your session, not just what the session is, but how challenging the session was. So give, like, maybe start practicing giving your session an RPE number. And you can use the old school Borg scale because it's good and it's communicates, it's easy to understand and communicate with. So and you can start creating how intense each session is throughout the week and start understanding like how hard it is to recover from that session. So it kind of has a training load and you start looking at how that fits in terms of the week. The second part to go along with that is the intensity is to, in my opinion, again, people have to, you have to practice and you have to understand different gears. You have to understand how to go slow and what that feels like. You have to understand how building up and pacing feels like. You have to understand what your true maximal pace is on all these different modalities is. Like, what's the fastest you can possibly go with burpees in doing bar facing burpees? What's the absolute fastest you can go? And then how do you go actually kind of slow on burpees? What does that feel like? And what does that look like? Because those are not, it's not the same two techniques. Like, it's different. Just as a simple example of you shouldn't just be doing burpees and it's always the same exact layout, exact same pace every single time. If you're trying to make progress in those things, just doing the same effort or providing the same stimulus is not the best strategy. So variation intensity is quite important, or whatever you want to call it, like polarization intensity is important. Thirdly, you have to assess what you're actually trying to do. Are you trying to get better? Like, are you trying to improve like your aerobic capacity? Are you trying to maintain it? Or are you trying to like, or are you knowingly just kind of let it go a little bit because that's already something you're very good at? So understanding it from that perspective as well is very important to know what you're actually trying to do. Because that leads into the actual fourth thing, which is scheduling an actual volume. So if you're someone who needs to get better at it, you probably are going to need to do more of it. Volume is just something that is going to work, but it has to be done appropriately. And then like on the other side of it, if you're someone who does not need to improve it, then you need to look at it of a way of go, I don't really need to do a lot of it. I'm just working to try to lose the least amount of it. But by doing that, you need to understand that you're just going to need to do less of it. And if you're going to do less of it, the majority of it should probably just be intensive work, and it should probably be mostly sport specific, I would guess. But in general, like the idea of what do you need to do? Get better, stay the same, or control how much worse you get. But within that, which is the missing, which is the main important, the main thing, in my opinion, is the mechanics of how you're doing all of this stuff. And this includes like doing the classic, like doing mixed work, like doing skip, doing double unders, burpees, like overhead squats, thrusters. There's an immense amount to be gained in doing things right. And again, it's to the point where if you take someone who's moves quite poorly, or just, and it's not even that they're mechanically move poorly, like they just do things sloppy because it's the way they're used to doing them. If they just learn how to do things a little better and in a little more efficient manner all the time, you may not actually need to get any fitter. You just might need to actually spend all your time practicing doing the movements perfectly. And if you just practice doing that, you're going to learn how to be the most efficient at all possible times, which is really what you want. And that's how aerobic capacity will function in CrossFit. Is you have this maximal pool of availability. Now, how do you get the most amount of work out of it? It's not by being sloppy. The way you get the most amount of work out of a fixed unit of energy is to make it as efficient as possible. So as you really pay attention and you really practice doing things, you have to have it of the mind going, how am I doing this and how can I do it a little better? And don't be afraid to experiment and try things differently. Because actually what you would see if you watch enough people is sometimes what seems sloppy might actually be the most efficient way for someone to do it. That might be the most efficient way. Even though some people would say that doesn't look very good. It's like, yeah, it doesn't look very good, but it doesn't fatigue them at all. So in a looks perspective, yeah, it doesn't look great. In a sporting perspective, that's exactly how they should be doing it. And there's like probably 40 or 50 main modalities you need to think about that in terms of the CrossFit Open. But really, really putting your effort into not just thinking of like aerobic capacity as just a dummy model of I just need to do the work and just get sweaty and work really hard and that'll fix everything. You need to do that stuff and you need to consider the other things we talked about, but you need to do everything well. And that in and of itself is what the best people in the sport do. And that's a really good thing, in my opinion, to emulate.
Yeah, there we go. A great summary. Cool. All right, Michael, anything else for the people?
For the people. Nope. Like I said, if they made it this far, thanks for listening. I really feel like we were kind of all over the place, which is fine because we're going to call it constantly varied information.
Yeah.
Or whatever. but yeah, it was just kind of, it was fun. It was just, it's kind of hard. It's hard to think about, honestly, for me, because I honestly think if this was 5 years ago, I would have had a really, really concise, like laid out answer for people. But I was wrong. I was wrong. But it was just being naive. Like I thought I understood how to do it. And it's just the classic like knowledge curve, right? Like you have this illusion that you get it. And then as you get farther into it, you're like, I don't really think I get this. Like you start questioning what you were doing, going, I don't know if that's actually the best way to do that.
Yeah. It doesn't work the way they said it would.
Yeah. And like the simple example is like the years ago when I stopped doing like the mixed lactic endurance work, like doing five sets of, or whatever, doing like 20 thrusters, 20 chest to bar, 20 second air bike, like murder yourself. Rests 5 to 10 minutes, do it, 4 to 6 times. I'm not really sure what benefit that has in terms of the sport other than just toughening someone up.
Yeah.
I think the main improvement you're getting there is psychological and not physiological.
Yeah. Or just even learning, like we said before, to work at that level of pace. Cause a lot of people don't know that they have that gear.
Yeah.
You can literally do your thrusters faster.
Yeah. So is the most important place to do that in a fatigue scenario, or is it more important to do that in an EMOM where they can practice the skill of moving faster?
Yeah.
Or in a less fatigue scenario. So that's what I meant when I first discussed One of the things I did years ago was everything was focused on the energy systems. And that's a simple example of going, well, maybe it's not just about the actual 2 minutes of work. Maybe it's more about how the 2 minutes of work is being done.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, man. Mm-hmm. Good words of wisdom there. Let's cut our broadcast. Good. We still got 9 people sticking with us all the way. You know,
the hardcore crew.
17 minutes past where we were supposed to be. So thanks, guys. And yeah, cool. We'll talk to you guys.
Hey, buddy.